Sarah Rubin, you?
That would be me.
Yep. I found the article that I ran into it this weekend that supported your point about stereotype threat for white males. didn't you make that point when we were talking about stereotype vulnerability? Oh, yeah, I guess that would, you're right, I'm sorry. This is about Asian Americans.
Okay.
Yep, and the study that was done at Northwestern. And what they did was to make, they took a group of Asian women, saw how they performed without any particular cues on a test. Then they cued identity as females. And this test was something that was particularly male-oriented. And the women did worse. Then they cued another comparable group with the cue Asian, and Asians generally are better at math and this sort of thing. And the women did better than in the control group. So it was a positive effect if you were cued that you're going to be better than other people, a negative effect if you're cued that you belong to a group that's likely to be worse than another group. So I think that was the point you were talking about. There are a couple of lectures that are kind of relevant to what we've been talking about. There's one this noon. Is there a developmental trajectory to homicide by young males? By a professor from the Free University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And it's going to be at the Center for Human Growth and Development, which is it's 300 North Ingalls Street, room 1000. It's up on the 10th floor. So if anybody interested, lunch is provided. But if you're interested in youth violence, that'll be an interesting lecture. And on Friday, there's a seminar on culture and cognition at 10:30 a.m. Friday by John Jost, who's a professor at Stanford, on the system justification function of stereotyping in Italy, Israel, and the United States. And I assume that's something about why stereotyping is maintained by various. That's going to be in 3048 East Hall at 10:30 a.m. Friday. We're now kind of at the midpoint of the course. That is, we finished general psychology last week, and developmental psychology now gets back to whole human beings, pretty much. General psychology is talking about variables within people that influence their behavior and tries to find general laws that affect all human beings, regardless of culture and so forth, which turns out to be very difficult to do. and now we get into things that deal much more with people as persons and their whole characteristics. We'll be talking about personality right after the break. Developmental psychology is essentially how the person develops. And in general, the pace now is going to slow. That is, you'll notice we're taking two sessions on developmental psych. We'll take three on personality. Your reading assignments will drop off in most cases. Well, it depends somewhat on which book you have on certain topics. Some books are longer than others, as it has also been the case previously. So you'll have more time to work on your team research once you get back. Today I'm going to try to do two things, and maybe a third. That is, I'm going to have you participate in a review exercise, which I hope will help you in getting schemas to use when you take the midterm on Wednesday. And I want to talk some about four or five points in developmental psych. I think your books cover developmental pretty well, but these are points that either aren't mentioned or that I want to highlight more or at least comment on. So I'll be giving the review exercise about every 10 minutes to break up the lecture. So it may seem disorganized, but essentially after each topic, or before the first topic, you'll be doing the review exercise. And then if we get time at the end, I'll say a little bit about test taking, which I talked about earlier, and some of the strategies that should help you on taking the test or preparing for it. So first, the review exercise. And this, you just do the top page to start with, and then the second page about 10 minutes later, and so on after that. So now start on the top page, and I'll tell you more about it later. This is an exercise that should help in building a general schema. And Ernie Zaremba, one of my doctoral students, who teaches psychology at Washtenaw Community College, carried out a neat set of studies showing that simply taking something like this actually helps in your performance later in the course on other topics as well as on the topic covered. So it doesn't necessarily mean that these terms are actually going to be on the test, but it should help you in getting a framework and probably also help you later on in the course in terms of developing schemas relative to the rest of the topics in the course. Thank you. How many are you through? Well, you can work on it while I talk. Basically, what developmental psychologists are trying to do is to find out what kinds of aspects of development are more or less universal, that are built into our species, and what kinds of things are pretty much determined by our culture, our parents, our environment. It turns out most things are an interaction of both. Even something like height is influenced a good deal by nutrition. Japanese are taller now than they used to be, for example. So there aren't any simple answers to the questions that developmental psychologists ask. And Sean and Ryan showed you in their class on Monday that here's something like the effect of TV violence, which seems like a fairly simple thing to study. And it turns out it's very complex. It affects some children in some situations to become more aggressive, but there are a lot of other variables that influence the effect. Parents and patterns of child rearing, whether the parents are aggressive or not. Peers, poverty has an effect. So it's hard to untangle any one effect from others. And most psychologists, I should say, do agree that television violence is on the whole pretty bad. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean that it's very good, bad, or bad for everyone. So the first of the 4 points that I wanted to make is about methodology. Cross-sectional method is essentially trying to study developmental processes by comparing the 5-year-olds with 2-year-olds, with 8-year-olds, and 10-year-olds, and so forth. And you take samples at each of several age levels, and you assume that the differences between the, say, the 5-year-olds and the 8-year-olds are a result of the development. But the problem is that what happens to an 8-year-old may be different from what happens to a 5-year-old who becomes 8 later, that the environment changes over time, and thus the cross-sectional method, it's the easiest method to use, but it sometimes gives you screwy results. So most developmental psychologists like to use longitudinal methods. And in longitudinal methods, you follow a group of kids or adults over a period of years. And people don't like to do that because it takes a long time to get, if you're working on a dissertation, I tell my students, don't use the longitudinal design because you got to wait until, you know, 5 years or something to find out how it comes out. So we need to use some other kind of design if you're going to get out of here in any decent period. But the longitudinal design has the advantage that you do see development sequentially in a given group of people. The problem is that the historical period or the culture that is, say, the group of people you're following, say, from 10 to 19, may be quite different for one cohort or one group of students than it will be from another group, say, 10 years later. My development, for example, was influenced by the fact that I was a boy during the Depression. World War II occurred. I had to go into the Navy. It was the McCarthy era while I was a young faculty member. A lot of things happened, the civil rights campaign, student activism in the 60s, the Vietnam War. All of these things influenced my development and are quite different from the development of the events that will influence your development over the next 50, 60 years from now. So longitudinal method has its problems too. And what psychologists have developed is what's called the cross-sequential method, which gets around some of the difficulties of both of these. And that's not mentioned in any of your textbooks as far as I can determine. Cross-sequential is essentially, if I want to study teenagers, I take and what happens, say, from 12 to 22, say a 10-year period. So I start out and I take a group of 12-year-olds and 15-year-olds and 18-year-olds and, say, 22-year-olds, and I measure them all and get measures on all of them. So I've got a cross-sectional analysis of development from 12 to 22. And then I follow each of these groups until they reach 22. So the 18-year-olds, I follow 4 years, the 15-year-olds, 7 years, 12-year-olds, 10 years, and so forth. So I've got the longitudinal data on them as well. But then in addition to that, each 3 years, say if I'm using a 3-year cycle, I pick up a new group of 12-year-olds and follow them too. So I get rid of the particular historical circumstances that affected the development of my first group of 12-year-olds as they moved up to 22 by seeing if the same sorts of things happen to a new group as they move through that period. That's called the cross-sequential method. And it's probably better than either of the others, and it's more expensive and more difficult to carry out. Okay, flip over your review sheet to the second page. Tony, you aren't finished. Okay, well, you can finish up while we go. Why do you suppose I took a break in between having you do the first and second page? Anyone have a guess? Basically, it's to get, presumably, out of your working memory what you did on the first page so that you approach the second page more or less drawing on your long-term memory rather than just kind of repeating exactly the same thing you did on the first page. And that's why we have a different keyword for you to start with in the second page, or maybe still a different one on the third page. Okay, second topic is stage versus continuity, stability versus change. And basically, I think it's been well established now for probably 50 years that we don't exactly progress the way Piaget thought we did. That is, Piaget had certain set ages that things were to occur and where certain transitions occurred. And it turns out some kids transitioned earlier, some later. Actually, some of the things he thought didn't occur till later. Now we find, as your books show, infants are really much better than we ever realized now that we have better methods of studying them. So that's the stages are helpful, I think, in giving us kind of a sense of things that happen in development. But the notion that development's kind of discontinuous, that is, that you're in one stage, then you make a sudden transition to another stage and so forth, then sometimes it does seem kind of amazing how all of a sudden a child who couldn't do something one day and just a little few days later all of a sudden can do something. So you can see how Piaget got the notion, he got it from his own children, that there were acute. I remember asking Levinson, the midlife crisis guy, once, well, does the midlife crisis have to occur at 40? Might it be later, say, for academics who don't actually get into their career until probably 30 or so, as compared with other people who start, say, going to work when they're 18 or 20? He said, nope, it's 40 years plus or minus one or two. Well, it's not. People can have crises at almost any time. But the problem is that once you get certain stage ideas into the culture, so people believe them, we develop stereotypes. If one of my colleagues falls in love with a student at age 40 or 45 or something, people say, oh, he's going through the midlife crisis. So we use these labels and kind of take it for granted. People get teenagers, for example. If a teenager does something parents don't like, they say, well, it's just teenage rebellion, because we've got a concept of adolescence. Other cultures don't necessarily have a concept that there's a stage called adolescence. So they don't have these stereotypes. And the stereotypes affect the people at that particular age, and they affect the perceptions of other people at that age. And even though we have these stereotypes, not all teenagers are rebellious. Most men don't experience a midlife crisis. The transitions don't occur when they're supposed to. What about stability versus change? General notion has been people pretty much stay the way they are. You're you, and you're going to be pretty much the same sort of person the rest of your life. Now that you've established your identity, which according to Erickson is what you should be working on now. Baldus and Brim. Baldus is at the Max Planck Institute in Berlin. Bert Brim is now retired. He's head of the Russell Sage Foundation. Both friends of mine. They published a whole book on continuity and change. What they showed was that there is some kind of stability. Most people are in the same environment. And as long as you're in kind of the same community, the same environment, with the same kinds of peers, family pressures, and so forth, you stay pretty much the same. But on the other hand, there is some kind of continuous development that probably depends upon your interests. You develop more knowledge. We've talked about crystallized and fluid intelligence. You develop more vocabulary, probably, if you're in a job that requires you to use words. So there's a certain amount of continuity, a certain amount of stability, and yet people at any age can change very dramatically. Probably the most common example is men tend to die before women. And you very frequently find that a woman who's been pretty much a conventional, say, homemaker in the old days, who acceded to her husband the way the Southern Baptists want their women to do, and who never took much responsibility for finances or anything else, all of a sudden kind of blossoms out, finds the strength, and develops the skills that are necessary to manage her own life very well. Religious conversions are other examples of people who make dramatic changes in their life. So there's always the potential for change. Okay, go on to the third page of the order. How many are through? Okay. Well, the third topic I want to take up is chance. I talked about Al Bandura's theory of observational learning. He's probably one of the, maybe the foremost kind of, I don't know if you'd call him a personality theory, a theorist or a developmental theorist or what have you. He's a great guy. And he has emphasized more than any other psychologist, because psychologists, are you awake, Phil?
I'm sorry.
Looked as if you were about to fall off. He emphasizes more than any other psychologist, probably, even though psychologists keep trying to find all of these variables that cause behavior in a certain way. He stresses, you know, no matter how hard we work, there's always the role of chance. We aren't going to be able to predict all behavior because chance variables play a big role. I keep telling people at basketball and football games, they don't realize how much variability there is and how much the outcome depends upon chance. Some of my best nights, they pop things out over the infield and I lose a game. Some nights when I didn't have much stuff, they'd hit them all at the fielders and I'd get a no-hitter. So that's pretty much chance, I think. They stick their bats out at the right spot by accident. Anyway, Al, for instance, told me once, he said, the thing that got me started on chance was that the way I met my wife was that I was playing golf, and she was in the foursome behind us, and she hit me with a golf ball. Well, that's kind of a chance occurrence, you know. Actually, when I was a senior, I didn't date much because I was playing in a bar at Novi on weekends. And I decided I'm going to have a date before I graduate. And we're going to have a dance in May. So toward the end of April, I decided I was going to ask one of two girls whom I admired probably for 4 years without really interacting with them at all for a date. Well, it happened that we took a bus out to Lincoln School to do our practice teaching. I was doing algebra, and my wife was doing the library, and my wife was sitting there waiting. So I asked her for a date, and she said yes, and a month later we were engaged to be married. So if the other girl had been there first, I'm telling you what would have happened. So chance variables play a big role in behavior. There's a chapter in a book called The History of Teaching and Psychology about me based on an interview with me. And they titled it, I Was Lucky, because I kept saying over and over as they asked me about things, I said, well, I was just lucky. I worked too. But basically, a lot of my career essentially depended upon being here at a particular time and place and being involved in things. Well, I was lucky to survive the war in the first place. But anyway, a lot of things are pure luck. And bad things can happen as well as good things. I mean, whole book of Job is about the fact that bad things happen to good people. Right now, sort of thing that kind of came up a little bit in talking about violence on television is resilience. That is, some people bounce back from bad events and become even stronger because of something that happens to them. I've heard people who've had heart attacks say, well, you know, I'm a much better person now because I quit smoking and I'm watching my weight and I'm exercising. And so they bounce back and become stronger as a result of what would ordinarily be considered a bad event. So chance is always going to be something that you need to think about when you think about human behavior. Okay, go on to your fourth page and last page. Let me explain to you what you've been doing when you're through, I'd like to have you pass them up to the front, and we probably, I don't know if we'll use them or not, we might analyze them. Basically, the method that we've been using is called the ordered tree method of studying ways concepts are structured inside your head. It was developed by Judy Reitman Olson, who is now a professor of psychology and business administration, and her student Henry Reuter, who took his PhD with her, to study laboratory. They give people lists of words to remember, and then they would give them this exercise to see which words tended to cluster together in recall or in ordering. Actually, I think they just had people recall words and looked at the order of recall rather than, as we did, write them down. I think maybe they did it both ways, come to think of it. Anyway, Moshe Navi Benjamin, my colleague at Ben-Gurion University, then developed this as a way that he and I could study learning in courses. And so we've used it now for probably 20 years. Maybe he's not that old, I don't know, 15, 20 anyway, to study learning in courses. And Ernie Zremba, my doctoral student, teaches seven, or at least at the time that we were doing this, was teaching seven sections of introductory psychology at Washtenaw Community College. So he had a chance to really run a lot of different variations. And so he would give this sort of exercise to one class and then see what their performance was later on. He'd give it to another class and then have them do it later in the term, see how they performed. He'd give it to another class and then go over the results kind of in a tree, such as I've done here, and see what effect that had. Then he compared that with a group that didn't do it at all. Well, just taking the thing once, as I suggested, made a positive difference as compared with those who never saw an exercise of this sort. Those who took it twice did somewhat better. Those who did the best were those who took it and then had some discussion of the organization. And he did it, I think he did it, for instance, in BioPsych. And even though they just discussed the tree in BioPsych, these students did better on mental disorders later in the term than students who hadn't had the tree in the discussion about it. So here is my tree of these things. And our computer program essentially will print out for each of you using that, assuming we get somebody to enter it and get it into the computer sometime, something like that for you. Generally, as you go through the term, what we find is that early in the term, the concepts are not particularly grouped together. You put them more or less randomly all four times. And maybe some of the concepts in psychology go together just in natural language, you get those together. So you have a few little clusters, but it's pretty much just a level thing with a few pairs here and there, not much of anything else in the computer program. As we go through the term, when we give it, say, beginning of the term, midterm, final, maybe one time in between someplace, what happens is that your conceptual structure gets more and more organized. That is, things get grouped together a little more consistently. And if the organization comes out to be similar to that of your professor, and that's not just in psychology, we've done this in biology and even in English, which is not as highly structured as biology and psychology, the more organized and the more your structure resembles that of your professor, the better grade you get. So it seems to be a pretty good measure of kind of how you're developing the schemas that we talk about, and presumably how well you're able to use them then in answering whatever is on exam questions. Any questions about it? Okay, well, pass them on up to the front, I'll collect them. And I'll go on to my fourth topic, which is children in poverty. This is covered really only in white of your four textbooks. And I think it's important that you all get it, even though it's not in the other textbooks. We have today 13 million kids who are in poverty. That's 3 million more than we had 20 years ago. So even though the nation's been prospering, things have been getting worse for children. As I probably mentioned before, a lot of our congressmen are against abortions, but they don't care if kids die or suffer once they're born. At least they don't want to appropriate any money for health care. We rank 23rd or 24th in the world in terms of infant mortality. That is, we have more babies dying than any other any other Western country. So we are in bad shape as far as children go. We don't give good education, good health care, good nutrition. Other countries provide health care for prenatal care for mothers and care for the mother and the child, health care in infancy. We don't do any of that. We'd much rather cut taxes for millionaires and put any money into the future. And one of the reasons, I guess, that I'm interested in this is one of the centers of research on poverty and its effect on children. A couple of the professors in social work are among the national leaders of research in this area, Danziger, I forgot Cohen. So we know a good deal about how poverty is related to children's development. Now again, let me remind you, it's the same way with TV violence. That is, it doesn't affect all children the same way, and poverty relates to a lot of other things. That is, generally speaking, probably kids who are poor spend more time watching television than kids whose parents are taking them to Little League baseball games and ballet lessons and everything else they can do. So these things tend to get intertwined. But John Hagen of our faculty in psychology and Fulman studied poverty and its effect on children in Detroit. They found that children who were in poverty were more likely to believe in aggression. That is, that you should fight. Somebody's taking something from you. There's a neat article in the current issue of the Psychologist, the British journal, that left to themselves, children in preschools quite often can negotiate and settle things. They do it better than if there's an adult there. If there's an adult there, they fight until the adult stops them. But if they're just by themselves, they negotiate. So children in poverty are more likely to have favorable attitudes toward aggression. They're more likely to be fearful of violence. I remember the National Academy meeting in Washington some years ago. We had a woman from one of the Chicago schools. And she said, the problem for our kids on the south side of Chicago is that the only place they're really safe is in the school. Problem is getting them there and back without getting beaten up or robbed or taken advantage of along the way. They are more likely to approve stealing. Drug dealing is normal in their situations. They have poor health, as I've already mentioned. And that's not necessary. Lyndon Johnson, when he was president, conducted a war on poverty and cut poverty to about 14%. Now we have that is 14% of children over in poverty. Now it's about 25%. So it's gone up, and there's no reason why it should in a wealthy nation like this. Let me just give you one suggestion for your journal. That is, it would be interesting, or if you don't do it for your journal, do it for your own interest. I've done this, and it's kind of fun. Draw a graphic representation of your own development. That is, put in kind of critical events, how you branched out maybe with different kinds of interests at different times, people who had some influence on you, your parents, your peers, aunts and uncles, grandparents maybe. If you want to, try to project it into the future and see what kind of critical events or things you think are going to happen in the future. But that would be a good way for you to kind of elaborate what you learned about development from your reading so far. If you're interested in developmental psychology, there's a book by my former teaching assistants or research assistants, Phil and Barbara Newman, which is probably the best-selling developmental psych book. There's also a very good one by Musson, Conger, and Kagan. If you're interested in continuity, the book by Baldus and Grimm, I mentioned Constancy and Change in Human Development is good. I've got some readings here, quite a few readings on test taking. And if you're interested in your own development, you might be interested in a book by Holahan, H-O-L-A-H-A-N, and Sears called The Gifted Group in Later Maturity. And this is a longitudinal study that studied a group of kids who scored in the top 1%, maybe it was the top half of 1%, highly gifted kids who were followed over, I think it's maybe 60 years now. Last I knew, they're still following those who are still alive. So that deals with kind of what happened to people with your range of intelligence. Let me summarize. One methodology, studying things in developmental psychology, has problems, as you saw in the studies on television, but we're able to get, nonetheless, I think, fairly reasonable evidence that gives you somewhat more confidence in certain variables that's affecting development, and the better design you have, something like cross-sequential, probably the sure you can be that your results are going to hold up. Two, people tend to be stable in personality and other characteristics, but they still always have great capacity for change. And I think that's what's tended to be underemphasized in our kind of folklore. Third thing, poverty is a major problem for children particularly. I mean, it's bad for anybody, but it has particularly bad effects on children. And fourth, don't forget the role of chance, but that nonetheless, even if bad things happen to you, you can always bounce back. For test taking, I guess, any questions about the test or strategies to use? They're going to be, I think, 8 multiple choice, 6 short answer, an essay, and you'll have your choice of essays. But plan your time, because we just have 50 minutes to get it in. We'll probably try to pass them out as you come into the room, so if you get here on time, you'll have a better chance to finish up. And I guess the main thing is be sure and read the heading. If it's a multiple choice question, read all of the alternatives in the heading. Be sure you've read it. I find that one of the things people miss the most is that they pick one of the first two answers and haven't read the other ones, which may turn out to be better. And we try to write in seductive alternatives. I mean, alternatives that maybe are partially right but aren't as good. In the same way for essays, yes. People underline key words in the essay test because people just forget that they were supposed to contrast it or compare it or done something else. Okay, good luck on Wednesday.